If we read the Babylonian stories of the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Enuma Elish and the Atrahasis tablets, an ancient story of our domestication emerges. These narratives suggest that human beings were indeed domesticated thousands of years ago in association with our move into city living and our discovery of agriculture. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, Shamhat finds Enkidu, the wild human, living in the wild alongside the animals. And through befriending him and introducing him to different foods and through bonding him with herself, she then prepares him to live in the city alongside the sky people. Shamhat is not a human being, she is a sky person. Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability. Get fully protected. Go to surfshark.com/fifthkind and get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content. In 1959, Russian geneticist Dmitry Belyaev, working for the Institute of Cytology and Genetics in Novosibirsk, USSR, embarked on a study of the red fox. Red foxes are naturally wild, aggressive, and fearful of human beings. His plan was to take a population of wild silver foxes, a variant of the red fox, and observe them for their reaction to human beings. Belyaev and his team collected 130 silver foxes, and they went to fur farms to find them. Now, ironically, fur farms had foxes which were somewhat more habituated to the company of human beings. And what Belyaev and his team were looking for were the foxes that were the least fearful of the human beings, the least aggressive towards human beings, the least aggressive towards each other, living unnaturally in larger groupings, and the least stressed out by living in an artificial and somewhat prison-like environment. Belyaev and his team selected the 130 that seemed best adapted by their own behavior to higher density living and proximity to human beings. Once they had their 130, they began breeding them. Now, each generation that they bred, they only used 10 to 20% of the foxes. And again, they just observed them for these behaviors. Which foxes were doing best in these unnatural environments, which were doing best living in higher densities, which were doing best in terms of their interaction with human beings. No training was done, they were simply observing for these behavioral traits, and then the top 10 to 20% on that score, they would breed again. Naturally, as the generations of breeding went by, these behaviors were reinforced through this selection. The foxes became better and better adapted to interacting with human beings, better and better adapted to living in high densities, better adapted and less stressed out by living in artificial environments. But something else was happening to the foxes. Not only was their behavior modifying from generation to generation without any training, but their physiology began to shift. Through the first five generations, the difference was only very subtle. Most of the foxes were still very wary of human beings, and with good cause. Most were still quite aggressive when they felt trapped by a human being. And only a tiny shift in the sense of friendliness from the fox to the human being. But after five generations, something began to happen. Foxes began to approach human beings voluntarily, and they would solicit human attention. They would come towards human beings and they would wag their tails. And that is when the morphological changes began. The foxes' tails began to curl, and there were minor coat color changes so that a patchwork of colors began appearing on the foxes. And from the 10th generation on, ears began to become floppy. Their play behaviors continued into adulthood, and the foxes began demonstrating a strong social bonding to human beings. The foxes even developed new vocalizations, which would elicit kind, nurturing behaviors from their human beings. They would approach them, lick them, wag their tails, and they would whine for attention, very much like a domesticated dog. So their behaviors were shifting, and their bodies were beginning to change. Now remember, they were being selected only for their behavior. Their adrenal response was lowering. They were becoming less stressed out. But as the behavior began to shift, their body shape began to change. In generations 20 to 30, the foxes, which would now walk with human beings, not only had piebald coats and wagging tails, not only would they approach human beings and lick them and solicit attention, but their snouts were becoming shorter, and their ears were getting floppier, and their skulls were changing shape. And they began to look more and more like dogs. From generations 30 on, the skulls had changed shape to the point where the bite strength was greatly reduced, and the teeth were much smaller. The jaws were flatter, and there was now crowding of teeth inside the mouths. They started having problems with wisdom teeth, and the social changes continued. They were friendlier and they were more cooperative with human beings and with one another. The foxes also began to age differently. They would keep their juvenile, more puppy-like face for much, much longer. And then it was noted that the menstrual cycle of the foxes was speeding up. Now remember, all that the scientists were selecting for was their behavior, and yet these physiological changes were happening to their bodies as a result. And so a breed of fox was emerging that was very amenable to human handling, would work with human beings, would live in packs, could live in higher densities, could be put in artificial environments, and they responded very positively. And in fact, they began soliciting the approval of human beings and the affection of human beings, making them far easier to live with and work with. In short, they had been domesticated purely by selecting for behavior. But what was so curious was the physiological changes. And these are the general physiological changes which occur in animals when they are domesticated. Researchers often call this cluster of changes domestication syndrome. And it shows up in dogs, pigs, cattle, horses, foxes, rabbits, and even lab rodents. The reason the behavioral changes cluster together with the physical changes is purely genetic. But it's interesting to think about that juvenile aspect. Because the foxes' faces were remaining juvenile-looking and puppy-looking for longer, they elicited more nurturing feelings and attitudes from the adult foxes. That makes perfect sense. Adults, of course, are going to want to protect their young. And if that protective, compassionate feeling could be extended to more and more foxes of older and older ages, of course, you are building a more amenable society of foxes, able to live together and look after each other rather than live individually in competition. And so these animals were becoming more social, more like pack animals, which in the wild, foxes are not. What strikes me about the study in silver foxes, and indeed the general pattern of domestication, is that these markers, this ability to live in larger social groups, and these physical changes and the smaller brains could all be applied to the history of Homo sapiens. If you compare modern Homo sapiens with our ancestors and our closest primate relatives, you will see all the same changes. A shorter snout. A mouth now overcrowded with teeth, so we have to remove wisdom teeth to make everything work. Lower bite strength, lower levels of reactive and proactive aggression. These are all the changes that we can see between us and our closest primate relatives, and when we compare ourselves with the morphology of our hominid ancestors. When we look at other animals, these changes are all evidences of domestication. We are weaker than our hominid ancestors. We have smaller brains, we have lower bite strength, we have crowded mouths, we're less aggressive. All the changes of domestication syndrome have been applied to us. Why is that? Now, mainstream anthropologists say it's because we self-domesticated, and that this self-domestication was something that occurred around the development of agriculture. Now, with agriculture, you have higher density living, and it is the precursor to city building and civilization building. With agriculture, you have surpluses. You can have a specialized society. You can have a settled community, and then comes city building, civilization building. And so there is a connection between domestication syndrome in human beings and our great leap forward into living as a civilization on planet Earth. Self-domestication is a pattern that can be observed in the wild. Compare a bonobos with a chimpanzee, and you may be looking at an example of self-domestication. Now, bonobos are wild animals, and yet they exhibit certain domesticated behaviors when compared with their closest cousins, the chimpanzee. Chimpanzees can be very violent. They can be sexually violent, they can be violent towards their young, and they can be violent from group to group. They go to war with one another. Bonobos are different. Their face shape is different. They are less physically strong. They are much more socially bonded. There has never been any observation of predatory behavior from bonobos towards one another. They are not aggressive towards one another. They are not aggressive towards their young, their females. They are a very happy, peaceable society, and they exhibit the behavioral differences and the physical differences associated with domestication. Bonobos look juvenile compared to chimpanzees, in exactly the same way that animal faces change when we domesticate them. Bonobos show extended juvenile periods, prolonged play, and delayed onset of aggression. Human beings show exactly the same pattern, but amplified. The childhood of human beings is doubled compared to other primates. Adolescence is a real physiological phase that takes some time in human beings, far shorter in our primate cousins. And in human beings, brain plasticity, our ability to continue learning and developing, continues far, far longer than in our primate cousins. By comparison to bonobos, human beings are hyper-domesticated. If when we look at the history of human morphology, we see all the marks of domestication, is it not reasonable to ask, did we self-domesticate? Or did someone else do that for us? Texts found among the cuneiform tablets of ancient Babylonia tell a different story. If we read the Babylonian stories of the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Enuma Elish, and the Atrahasis tablets, an ancient story of our domestication emerges. These narratives suggest that human beings were indeed domesticated thousands of years ago in association with our move into city living and our discovery of agriculture. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, Shamhat finds Enkidu, the wild human, living in the wild alongside the animals. And through befriending him and introducing him to different foods and through bonding him with herself, she then prepares him to live in the city alongside the sky people. And so this is one story of human domestication, which we find in the Epic of Gilgamesh, and which has been echoed in the ages since by Edgar Rice Burroughs in the stories of Tarzan, by Rudyard Kipling in the stories of Mowgli and the Jungle Book. Shamhat is not a human being, she is a sky person. And she is in that story domesticating Enkidu until we have a human being adapted for city life. Writing in the 3rd century BCE, the Greek-Babylonian priest Berossus tells the story of the Sumerian miracle. Sumer seemed to emerge from nowhere with agricultural science and then all the technologies that came with that. So the ability to do civil engineering, to canalize and irrigate the environment, to build cities and to administrate them, with writing systems, record keeping, mathematics, cosmology, and, says Berossus, all the accoutrements of civilization. Now, according to Berossus, this was not a natural leap forward. This was the result of tuition by other beings, non-human beings, whom he called the Apkallu. When the human beings first saw the Apkallu on the shores of the Red Sea, they didn't know what they were looking at, and they described them as a horrifying-looking monster. And it was only as they began interacting that they realized these beings were not hostile and were in fact here to teach human beings to live in higher densities, to live in cities, to be less competitive and aggressive towards one another and learn to cooperate with one another in civil engineering, city building, and all the accoutrements of modern civics. According to Berossus, we didn't self-domesticate, we were domesticated by the Apkallu. One of the reasons I'm so fascinated by the Van region and why I take people on tour there every year is that there is so much reportage of this story embedded in the symbology left behind by people who lived there thousands of years ago. This moment in human history when agricultural science had to be discovered or rediscovered in order to establish the development of high-density living, cities, civilization. It is in the inscriptions in cuneiform text, and it is in the symbology carved into basalt, which you can find across, not only across the Van province, but into the Bitlis province, across modern-day Turkey, across modern-day Armenia, through the Armenian highlands, which were once Upper Mesopotamia, and then down into what today is Iran, Iraq, and Syria. These stories are told. Now, our ancestors had no problem identifying that we had been domesticated. And our own fossil record tells us that we were domesticated at a certain point in our development. The controversial question is whether we self-domesticated, like the bonobos, or whether we were domesticated by others, like the silver fox. The story of Oannes and the Apkallu suggests we were domesticated so that we could be more easily managed. It was easier for the Apkallu to manage human society if we were living more densely and if we had these administrative systems, money systems, legal systems, patterns of employment, rather than everyone living subsistence style off the land, it was easier to govern human society that way. And it was done so that non-human beings could govern us. Of course, in the ages since, we human beings have found the same to be true. And many countries have policies of urbanization, which have been rolling on for centuries, moving people off the land, dispossessing people so that they have to live in cities, they have to get jobs, they have to work for money in a giant project of domestication. You can see it in that context. Is this a behavior we learn for ourselves, or is the Greek Babylonian priest Berossus right that we learned it from others when we were governed by others? What's indisputable is that someone or something has domesticated us. Our very skeleton reveals that fact. If the Greek Babylonian priest Berossus is reporting something that happened in the history of human development, is this a cause for concern? The ability to live domesticated is incredibly important to human beings. The fact that we have learned to live in larger social units, that we have learned to live in cities as a specialized society, has been a massive leap forward for human beings. All kinds of progress, medical, scientific, social, have been made because we have learned to live in this way. And our ability to look at one another, not with this survival of the fittest competitive urge, but rather with a feeling of compassion and solidarity and unity and nurturing attitude. This is incredibly important if you're going to live in a society. If we live in a society and feel that everyone else is in competition with us, for jobs, for money, whatever it is, this is not only atomizing and damaging psychologically, it's damaging to our cohesiveness as a society. We have to be able to look at one another and say we, us, and think in those terms. And when you think about that pattern of juvenile faces, we are wired, aren't we, to look at a cute face and say, "Ah," and feel nurturing towards that person. We are deeply wired to feel protective towards people who look young and youthful, even though they might have no need for our nurturing at all. This deep wiring has to do with us becoming more of a social being. This is not a negative thing at all. This has been essential to so much specialization and so many phenomenal leaps forward that we've made as a species. Could it be that higher levels of compassion, solidarity, and cooperation, for which human beings are known, may be traits that were bred into us by sky people like Shamhat in the Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh, and the non-human Oannes and the Apkallu? I find that a really interesting speculation, because I think many people, when they start reading the Anunnaki narratives of the ancient Babylonian texts, can begin to form a view that we're nothing but a slave species, or that we've been nothing but exploited by other civilizations that may have visited us in the past. The truth may be more subtle. The Babylonians did not see it as a negative thing that we were better able to live in large social units, that we were able to build cities, that we were able to irrigate the environment. When Berossus wrote the history of Babylonia, he didn't think he was telling a dark story of interference in human development and exploitation of Homo sapiens. He was celebrating the beginning of civilization on Earth. And I wonder if we need to learn to see it the Babylonian way and realize that all those things that enable us to live together, a nurturing feeling towards one another, a sense of compassion towards one another, lower aggression towards one another, we need to see these as positive things that were contributed to our story by contact we had with others, that make it possible for us to live as communities and prosper as cities and as a civilization on planet Earth. The Babylonians did not think they were putting humans down by seeing our story in a wider context of paleo contact. And I don't think we should see that as a demeaning storyline either. We need to learn to see it the Babylonian way. The human story is an incredible story of terrestrial development and extraterrestrial interventions. And it's resulted in a species capable of incredible things. Would you like to go deeper with these questions? If selective pressures can shape species within just a few generations, then what were the pressures that shaped us? And who was it who was doing the shaping? In the Atrahasis epic, our ancestors told a story about us being shaped as a workforce. Now, that's not metaphorical. That's not a fringe idea. It is written into one of the oldest narratives known to humanity. Now, if you'd like to explore the Atrahasis story in its own words, I've created a course that does exactly that at Ancient Knowledge Academy. In this deep dive, we walk through portions of the text line by line, comparing it with Genesis and other ancestral stories. We make a similar journey through the Bible and a similar journey through the works of Plato. And our journey widens to explore deeper questions about human origins and human consciousness. At the Academy, we find ways of bringing ancient and ancestral story to bear on our own worldview. If you're on a journey of reframing faith or old beliefs or reframing your worldview to get a deeper understanding of who we really are, what our history tells us as a human species, what our potential is, then you will enjoy the topics we explore at Ancient Knowledge Academy. We look at ancient civilizations and ancient texts. We consider lost time and study how belief systems can shape perception. Without panic, without dogma, and with an open mind to continue in our journey of exploration. And if you'd like to stand in the landscape where so many of these origin stories converge, the lands around Lake Van, the lands of modern Turkey and ancient Armenia, the place many traditions point to as the reboot of civilization, I take a group there every year because standing in the place itself is very different to reading a story. If you'd like to join me in the Van province, go to ancientknowledgetours.com. And if you'd like to continue a journey with an online learning community, come to ancientknowledgeacademy.com. Wherever you are in your journey, whether you're just curious or if you're redefining how you understand humanity, you are very welcome to continue your exploration with me.